This is The Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of The Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me is Will. And
if you've never seen me, because this is the portion where I don't say anything after Sam introduces me, but you could see me. You could see my wave. So if you're an audio-only listener on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your listening devices, you can see us on YouTube. And we'd love for that to happen.
That's awesome. We also have coming up into the Christmas season.
It is almost Christmas.
And so we're not going to be doing special Christmas episodes this year. Instead,
we have old Christmas episodes that are evergreen, we've decided. So if you would like our thoughts on Christmas, which we love. We love to talk about Christmas, and we think those episodes are great. So that is episodes on YouTube, episode 26, 27, 28, 29, and 29.5.
Nice.
So we want to journey with you this holiday season. You can find us there.
And we'll be doing the daily shows that are all around through the period of Advent that'll be focused on Christmas. Lots of good stuff. And if you like this show, one other announcement. We have another show called Under the Hood. If you have not seen it, a lot of that is dealing with like the historical context of the more famous stories, apologetics, archaeology, all that kind of fun stuff. So if you're like me and you nerd out on that kind of stuff, you'd love that show. Check it out. Like, subscribe, do all that good stuff. But today we are continuing in our study in the life of Moses in the book of Exodus. And we're jumping into chapter 7, and this is where the contest begins.
It's exciting.
Like, I love this. I love, like, God is going to war against Egypt, Pharaoh, all the false gods of Egypt, and he tells all of these stories and ordains them into history in a way that when you look at them, it's so obvious that it's not just random plagues sent out to, you know, make people suffer or to impress people. He is legitimately, one after the next, tearing down different beliefs of the Egyptians, different gods of the Egyptians. And it's like sovereign poetry where God is doing this amazing, really awesome thing by tearing down the idols of the Egyptians.
And I think that's super interesting because I think I grew up too Christianized, so I never like blinked at just God sent plagues. That was just like, that was a story I was used to. Like, God sent plagues. That's what he does. But it is one where you're like, okay, why is he doing this? Because it does just seem, it could just seem cruel as punishment.
Yeah.
Back at a whole nation just because one guy's making a decision.
And I think one of the things that you'll see him and hear him say again and again and again throughout these coming chapters is the Egyptians will know that I'm the Lord.
Yeah.
And there's two sides of that, like two different meanings behind that. One is for those that are opposing me and those that are standing against me and those that are trying to bring about the evils of Egypt and make them triumph. They're going to know that I'm the Lord.
Yeah, my power.
My power. But then the other side of that really is evangelistic. Hmm. They're going to know that I'm the Lord, which means once they, if they realize that their idols are powerless, if they realize that their gods are powerless, they're going to know I'm the Lord and they're going to come out of Egypt with me. And we know that that was the case. And in Exodus 12, we're told that a mixed multitude came out with the Israelites. Well, what does that mean?
Not just Israelites.
Not just Israelites. There's Nubians that come out. There's Egyptians that come out. There's a lot of different people that come out with them because they came to know that Yahweh is the Lord, right? And so all of these are evangelistics. And in Genesis 12, verse 12, God will actually say that he's coming to bring judgment on, and you're waiting for him to say Pharaoh or the Egyptians. He says, no, I'm coming to bring judgment on the gods of Egypt. And so all of these plagues are being brought to tear down the idols. And before we get in, this is kind of a spoiler alert for where the application for these, because there's all kinds of cool historical stuff going on here. And when you hear plague, you think, ooh, God's mad and mean, right? But God is on a mission to smash idolatry. And if you understand that perspective of where God is coming from in this, that yes, it is judgment for the wickedness of the Egyptians, but it is mingled with a preaching that's like, walk away from those gods, come to me. Then you begin to understand that if idolatry yields slavery to where you consider something else a master that can never satisfy you, what is the most loving thing that God could do?
Get rid of that thing.
Smash it. Take it away. And that's what's going to be happening through these plagues. God is going to come and be like, oh, you think Osiris is a big deal? Smash. You think Hekt is, Ra is, all these different gods? I'm going to smash them all. And I can look back in my life, because the story of Exodus is basically the story of salvation for the nation of Israel, but you can take all the aspects and apply it to yourself.
Yeah.
And when I look back at my life, like when I came to faith, that is precisely what the Lord did with me. When I came to the crisis where I was looking for anything that could make sense of life and give hope and purpose, it was because he'd smashed all my idols. You know, like if I go back into that season as in my early 20s, everything that I was like, oh, I got a solid life, you know, got a great relationship with my parents, good friends, got a relationship over here. I've got a job where I'm making good money. And then 9/11 happens and my job, which is in the finance industry, just gets really uncertain. Nobody wants to do anything. My income starts dropping. I'm, you know, flying into addictions, making my reputation a mess. My parents might split up. My dad for a season disowned me, or at least didn't want anything to do with me because my mom came to live with me. Like all my friends started drifting into really, really bad things. And it was hard. Like everywhere where I could find any stability just blew up all at once. And I can just remember thinking like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good.
This hurts. And like, if there's a God, why are you doing this to me? And in that moment, like if you could go back and interview Sam walking through those days, like my conclusion would be like, God's mean.
Yeah.
He's taking away all the things I love. But when I look back, he smashed all those idols, so I had nowhere else to stand but him. And now that I'm standing on him, because I had no other options at that season, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Like all the blessings that I enjoy now came because he destroyed those idols. And so God, through these plagues, is going to do something beautiful. And it's not just I'm a just God and I'm meeting out the punishment.
Hurling it from the sky.
Yeah, it's wake up. Like these idols are making you hopeless. They're bringing you toward destruction. Wake up while you still can and see those idols are powerless. Come to me, the one God who can give you meaning and purpose and everlasting life and all of the abundance of satisfaction that this world can't give you. And when you think of it in those terms,
much different.
The most loving thing God could do for us is to start smashing our idols. It's no fun. It's not fun to walk through. Wouldn't want to do it again. But man, the fruit of what came through it, I thank God that he put me through those seasons because it yielded everything that I now have and consider precious.
Yeah, I love the image of the gardener's never closest to his plants than when he's pruning them. I think that's one where it's like, oof, all right, God's doing something with this. And that helps to get my mind around it because in those seasons, it is like, why me? What are you doing here?
Yeah. And even now, I've still got idols where I'm like, if God took good things, like because an idol's not necessarily a drug addiction.
It's not all evil.
Yeah, it can be a good thing that just
becomes a God thing.
Becomes God. It displaces God, right? And I still think about that. Like, man, I hope God doesn't take this away. I hope God doesn't take, you know, you name it. Good things like this show. I enjoy doing this show. I hope God doesn't take it away. But if it becomes an idol, the best thing he could do for me is to take it away. You know, it's like you come to realize that he's good and he's righteous and you can trust him even when it comes as pruning, you know?
I love the idea that St. Augustine, when he calls sin disordered love, because I just do this exercise a lot because I'm scared of idolatry in my life, of taking a list and numbering 1 to 5 and saying, okay, what if somebody looked at my life, how would they number the loves right now? Like, obviously, I want my kids on there. I want my wife on there. But would someone from the third party look and say, God is number one? If not, how do we work on that?
Yeah. And the fun thing is when you rightly order them,
everything else is,
you love the other things better.
Yeah.
You love your wife better when God's number one. You love your kids better when he's number one. You're a better boss. You're a better employee. You're a better all those things when you rightly order the love. And that's what God is after.
It's like he designed it for a purpose.
Right? Huh? Yeah, it's true. And so today, like the last chapters, 5 and 6 from last week, remember, the Israelites are not so happy with God and Moses. Why? Because God comes along and is like, I'm going to deliver you. You know, Pharaoh's going to harden his heart and da-da-da-da-da. But then that actually happens, and Moses comes and says, let my people go. And Pharaoh's like,
no chance.
Who is the Lord that I should serve him? And then he says, you know what? As punishment for you even approaching me, I'm going to impose even harsher slavery on everyone. They're going to have to go get their own straw. Their workload is going to increase substantially. Mm-hmm. And all of the people are really mad at Pharaoh, right? No, they're mad at
Moses.
They're really mad at God. They don't want Moses to do anything for them anymore. And then you get to Exodus chapter 7, starting in verse 1. God doesn't say, well, you know, be gone then. The Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh. And your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. So this seems really bizarre, right?
Yeah.
Like, why in the world would God say, I've made you like God to Pharaoh? What's the purpose of this?
Yeah, because it does seem weird. We don't we just talked about God and making God things. So it does seem weird for the Bible to say, okay, I've made you like God.
Mm-hmm. And so in this, like, I think there's a couple of things, and these are guesses, right? I think God wants this deliverance story, which is like the ultimate foreshadowing of Jesus. This whole thing is going to be pointing us to the gospel all throughout. And so God says, he starts by saying, I want you, a man, to be like God. Hmm. Right? What do you hear in that?
I mean, Jesus became man while still being fully God.
Yeah. Again, Jesus is actually God. He's not like God. He is actually God. And he is coming into this story to deliver his people. And he is going to go to war against the serpent, you know, king. And he's going to deliver his people from the land of death. And so already you see some parallel. But this would have been also an incredible show of disrespect to Pharaoh and how the Egyptians heard it. Because what's the last meeting Moses just had with Pharaoh? Who is the Lord? One. And by the way, you get out of my face, and I'm going to make all of your people work their fingers to the bone and be driven to utter exhaustion. And so now God is coming and he's saying, remember, you used to be a prince of Egypt, but Pharaoh's a god over you. Well, no. Now you're going to be the god, and he's going to have to submit to you. Hmm. And by the way, I'm not going to talk with him directly because he doesn't warrant me talking to him directly. And by the way, Moses, he's not going to get an audience with you, at least initially. Aaron, you're the unknown slave that's just come out of this, who's never had any titles in your life. You be the prophet. You're going to be the one whom he gets an audience with. And if you're Pharaoh, how dismissive and disrespectful would this feel?
Super.
Right?
I mean, he's never felt this, probably.
Mm-mm. No one has ever done this to him. Like, you're kind of wondering, like, what in the world kept him from just being like, army, yeah, like, destroy
them. Let's get rid of them. I mean, God, but yeah.
Correct. That's only thing there. But God is putting Pharaoh in his place. Mm. And there's another interesting thing where Aaron initially is going to be the one who leads the first three plagues, which you can read right past, but it's going to be Aaron that uses his staff to bring about each of the first three plagues. And I was trying to think, like, why would God do that? And there's a couple of things that jumped out at me. So Aaron does the first three plagues. You know what else is unique about the first three plagues? It's going to be the blood in the waters, frogs, and then lice or gnats. But what's unique about those plagues? They don't just impact
those affect Egyptians. Everybody.
They impact the Israelites and the Egyptians. And for whatever reason, God said, Aaron, you're in charge of those, which is thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, Aaron's role kind of diminishes, and then none of the plagues impact the Israelites anymore. And I wonder, like, I don't know, all conjecture, but it's like, I wonder if God did that to build Moses up. Like, I want you to be a god, but Aaron's going to handle the first ones, and they're going to be pretty substantial and impressive. But then when you finally take the pole position, when you finally sit in the driver's seat where I've been calling you to all along, Moses, watch what happens then. Your people will be protected, and they're going to see that my anointing is on you in a very special way, which kind of stinks for Aaron, but for Moses.
Yeah, Aaron, real scapegoat to be like, hey, look, the people didn't kill Aaron after he sent plagues on them too. So yeah. You're good, Moses.
Yeah. And it also makes me wonder, like, okay, if Aaron is to represent the human element of the prophets, it's still messy and lots of people are getting hurt in this.
And good for Aaron. He doesn't get enough play. So yeah. Good work.
Yeah. So then another part of this is, how does Moses actually become like God in carrying out this mission? And it's in all the ways that you wouldn't expect. Because the thing that you want to say is, okay, Moses is seemingly going to have authority over the natural order. He's going to bring about these plagues. He's going to raise a staff and crazy things happen, right? But beyond that, I just made a list. And some of this is a little bit repetitive, but I think we can step back and go, man, like God, Moses will selflessly pursue people who don't want him. Like God, Moses will show remarkable patience and an unwillingness to leave them. Like God, he'll be repeatedly threatened and hated by those that he seeks to rescue. He'll be betrayed and despised by his own people who call for his death. Mm-hmm. He will plead with his enemy to repent, giving chance after chance. He'll extend mercy to Pharaoh even when he gives the slightest hint that he's willing to turn, even though they're all not genuine. And the offers of mercy will not continue forever. He will ultimately act to redeem the faithful, and he'll destroy the wicked. So it's like, yeah, kind of like God. And by the way, being like God sounds really hard,
yeah,
and painful. This is not like a joyride for Moses. He gets a lot of bad things. And when we hear, you're going to be like God, you're like, oh, I want to be like God. But do you?
It's not all power and prestige.
Moses spends a lot of his life in pain and loneliness and alienation, being hated and everything else. And it's like, we don't think that way.
Yeah, he doesn't seem sacrificial at every turn.
No.
Because in the big, his big moments are huge, but it feels like the little moments are like the cuts that break him, it feels like.
And they're
like, they're paper cuts, but there's a million of them.
And they're relentless. Yeah. It's like, as people, we never learn and go, gee, you know, Moses, I know this cost you a lot. Thanks so much for leading us. It's like the only time he hears from them is when
everything's going bad.
When they're grumbling and they're like, you're trying to kill us. We know it. Where's like, you're food? Against us. It's always grumbling at him. And so, which, you know, he's learning what it's like to be like God in that too. But I think in this sense, it's saying you're going to have authority. I just think it's interesting that Moses really does figure out a lot of what it's like to be like God here. Verse 3, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. So God has said this from the start.
That's what's going to happen.
And by the way, remember what we talked about when it says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, for those who missed that episode? Do you remember?
So it's judgment.
It's judgment. So that word, to make heavy, stems from the Hebrew word that's kaved or kavod, and it means to give weight to. It's glory. It's like God is glorious because he has the most weight. He's weighty. And this is saying, I'm going to make Pharaoh's heart not just hard, like stubborn, but I'm going to make it weighty. And in the Egyptian afterlife, what happened to you? Your heart was
weighed against a feather.
Weighed against the feather of truth. And if it was too heavy, you were sentenced and condemned to judgment. So anytime the Bible says this, every Egyptian, all of ancient culture would have heard this and been like, Yahweh is using the Egyptians' beliefs to illustrate that this Pharaoh is being judged. Mm. And then apart from that, I think this was helpful. Like, the human heart naturally, without God, is hard.
Yes.
Like, the Bible repeatedly says that we have hearts of
stone.
Stone, right? It's Ezekiel 36:26 that says, I'm going to give you a new heart and a new spirit I'll put within you. I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. And it's like, I was thinking about this. It's almost like, with stone or cement or whatever. You ever see the cement trucks that are, what do you notice about them?
I used to be terrified of those as a child.
Why?
That would roll off and hit our car. So just know that's a deep-seated fear.
That's amazing. So you just would sit next to it being like,
I don't know why. Yeah, like maybe I just didn't trust that it'll just rotate by itself, but it looks like it should. But keep going with your illustration.
Why does it have to do that?
Because it's got to keep mixing it or else it'll harden.
That's it. And so, like, the illustration is, if God is not moving in your life, even when you're an unbeliever and the common grace of God mm-hmm. is helping you not become the worst possible version of yourself, if God stops moving in your life, there's no limits to the evils you could do. Mm. And I think with that, it's like God's like, okay, Pharaoh, I'm giving you over
to your own devices.
You're going to be hard as stone. And he goes on, he says, the Egyptians shall know that I'm the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. And so this is where we talk about Exodus 12:38, a mixed multitude went up with them. But what God is saying is by the time that this is over, every single person in Egypt is going to know I'm the Lord.
Yes.
And we have that same promise in the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
Every
knee
will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord, right? Well, what does that mean? That's good news and bad news. How are people going to kneel?
Either in submission because they did give their lives to Jesus, or it will be, you know, a hopeful submission that finally they realize he is who he says he is, but too late.
That's it. Like, you're either going to do that out of reverence and awe and recognition. You are the one who's purchased me. I owe my life to you, and I love you, and I can't wait to be with you. Or that humiliating, it's too late.
Yeah.
And he is the ultimate power, and I now realize that, and I can't do anything to stand against his power, so I have to submit. Except I don't want him. I've hated him my whole life, and now my kneeling is not coming from a place of desire. Verse 6, Moses and Aaron did so, and they did just as the Lord commanded them. So I love the simplicity of this. Like, they don't have to, like, go, all right, time out. God gave us some instructions, but let's come up with the game plan of how this is going to actually work. And it just says they did as the Lord commanded them, and that was enough.
And they actually did the wording, because earlier in the chapters we saw he did not say exactly what God said, and that didn't work out so great.
Yeah, that's right. And he did the same thing with his father-in-law, where he's like, I need to go back and see if they're still alive. Well, that's not what God said. And then when he confronts Pharaoh, he twists God's words because there's something in him that's not sure. But now you see some boldness. Moses is going to get bold with Pharaoh going forward. And so the winning formula is not go scheme on your own to help God along. It's trust and obey. And that works here, but it would have taken crazy amounts of courage to go before the most powerful man in the world at the time and say, I'm against you.
Yeah.
My God is against you, and I'm about to bring suffering to you if you don't obey my voice.
Woo! Took all 80 years of confidence to do that.
Man, that's a turn. So you get to the first of the miracles here, which involves the staff turning into a serpent. And we've talked about this a little bit, but getting into it more. It says in verse 8, then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when Pharaoh says to you, prove yourselves by working a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron. So it's like Moses being like, take care of my lightweight, right? Like, take your staff and cast it down before Pharaoh that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron cast down his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Now, in Egypt, the serpent's a big deal. I mean, not only do you have the uraeus on Pharaoh's crown, right, but the god of chaos was named Apophis, and he was a serpent god. He was, every night they believed when the sun set, Ra was under the earth and going into the grave, and Apophis was after him, trying to capture and kill the chief of the gods. And every single night, Ra would have to escape. Apophis was called the eater of souls, right? Mm. So the serpent in Egyptian culture, like, is associated with chaos, is associated with the enemy of Ra as well. And in the Book of the Dead, which is like the Bible for Egypt at this time, they would give these incantations where the priest would offer up these prayers every night. And I want to read some of them because it brings out more symbolism that everybody sitting in the court of Pharaoh is going to understand. So, like, here's some of the things that the priest would say. May thy soul be destroyed, talking to Apophis, the serpent god, for thou art cut up, thou art driven off the sacred bark, thou art exorcised, thou art felled, the eye of Ra devours thee. What do you hear there? What's being devoured? Apophis, the snake god, is devoured by the chief of all gods. Then in the coffin scrolls, it says the uraeus of Horus, which is the snake, consumes thee. It devours thee in order to satisfy its heart. Now, the uraeus of Horus, that marked the pharaoh, right? Yeah. It was this divine kingship. And so it's saying it devours Apophis. The rightful king devours Apophis. Horus in the flesh controls the serpents and devours them. And so now what's going on? God's not just like, hey, this sounds like a cool trick. He's like, no, I want to teach them something. You go in and you take your staff. Do you know what a staff represented?
Dead stick.
It's a dead stick, one. But beyond that, it meant that you're in authority over something. As a shepherd, you're in authority over your flock. And in the Bible, this word, it's the Hebrew word for staff is mata. And you know that that word is not usually translated as staff. It's 72% of the time, it's translated as tribe.
Huh.
One and the same, because your staff represented all the people that
are under you.
Are under you, right? So if you carry the staff, you're a leader, you're a shepherd of people. And 72% of the time, 184 out of 257 times this word is used, it's tribe. And so in this instance, it's one and the same. So in the Jewish Mishnah, it says the staff represents the people and the people represent the staff. And so now, who's represented in this staff?
The Israelites.
The Israelites throw it down, and then it becomes a snake, right?
Wild.
And then you're thinking through, like, wait a minute, like devouring snakes and all that stuff. And then Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers, and they, the magicians of Egypt, also did the same by their secret arts, for each man cast down his staff, and they became serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Now you're going, I know my mythology, and I know that it's the greatest God.
Who eats the other one.
That, right. I know that it's the divine king that swallows up the snakes, and now Moses and Aaron just show up, and their emblem of kingship to represent the tribe and all the people has been thrown down, and it swallowed up ours? This is not how that story's supposed to go. And all of Egypt is going, that doesn't bode well for us. Maybe Pharaoh's not the rightful king. Maybe our gods are not the true gods.
That makes a lot of sense.
So what do you do with this?
Because again, this is a weird for God to choose how he's doing this. But again, with the background of snakes devouring snakes, being the champion, that is wild.
Yeah, and you know, in the New Testament, these magicians are named.
Are we going to talk about that? Is this real? Did they actually do it?
Yes, I think, but let's hang on. And 2 Timothy 3:8 and 9, they're called Jannes and Jambres. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But there was a guy who does Near Eastern studies at the University of Toronto who went and did a search for where these people, these two magicians, are mentioned throughout all of antiquity and all the sacred and writings of different cultures. He found their names mentioned in Jewish, Christian, Arabic, Aramaic, Greek, Hebrew, Latin, Old, Middle English, and Syriac languages. Like, these guys were famous and their names continued on even into New Testament times. They're not mentioned in Exodus. Their names aren't mentioned. But their names carried on in tradition because they were so impressive, and we know their names now, which is interesting. So then the question, your question is, did they really do this?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's my question.
I think so, because like when you look at it, it says, quote, they did the same by their secret arts, which is like that. The words there are like literal occult magic. It's not saying like illusion or trickery. It's like there's a dark magic at play, and that's the words that are used here. And so that's something that the New Testament, by the way, comes along and says, you know, when we're eventually going to be facing the lawless one, and it's talking about end times and the evil figures that come, listen to what it says, that they will carry out, quote, the activity of Satan with all power and false signs and wonders. And so in the New Testament, you find, yeah, that's what we're going to see in the end times. If we're alive when that happens, you're going to see things that you can't explain in the natural order. And if you believe in the supernatural order, then that would make sense, right?
Yeah, it's one where we don't like to talk about it, but it is when we're like, if there's good, there's evil, there's good spirits, there's bad spirits, there's God, and then there's also Satan who's prowling around.
That's right.
Who doesn't have ultimate power, but who does have.
Yeah, so I put together a list a while back of like just demonic powers. That's the number one miracle Jesus does in the New Testament, is casting out demonic spirits.
You found a lot of them.
There's a bunch. But it's the Gadarene demoniac is able to rip iron chains and shackles apart. There are demons, Mark 9, that cause cases of muteness, deafness, and blindness. There are demons that cause seizures and insanity and paralysis. There's a demon in Philippi that is able to tell the future. There's a satanic attack against Job, and what's he able to do? I mean, there's storms and crazy things, and things are dying, and diseases come. Like, so that's demonic. Yeah. King Saul had evil spirits. He was able to communicate with Saul, Samuel's ghost.
A necromancer.
Through demon spirits. And so the Bible comes to you and says, yeah, there's a demonic realm. And this demonic realm has power. And in this ancient world, how in the world are they able to turn a staff into a snake? It makes zero sense. I mean, unless they are like some crazy illusionist as to how they would be able to do this.
And they're just responding to Moses. They're like, Moses didn't say, hey, here's what I'm going to do. You guys prepare yourselves.
Right.
Like, this is an instantaneous reaction.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's not like they're like, hey, let's go train.
Let's go to the back.
Let's go train a snake to be really still.
Stick snake.
Pretend. Yeah. But anyway, like, this is telling you that there's something going on there. And it, we mentioned this in our last time when God does this sign with Moses in preparation. But there's symbolism here. If the staff represents Israel, and it's the tribe anyway, and it's thrown down to become a snake, and then it devours it. Literally, the language just swallows up the other snakes, and then he grabs it, and it's restored to a staff. The language of Messiah that comes later on in the prophets is always swallowed up.
Yeah.
Like death is swallowed up in victory. Listen to Isaiah 25, verse 7 and 8. It says, he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. What is that? Death, right? It's all over all of us. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. And then you get to 1 Corinthians 15:54, when Paul has just made an incredible case for the resurrection. And he quotes this, and he says, when the perishable puts on the imperishable, in other words, when something that should be mortal becomes immortal, mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying, death is swallowed up in victory. And so here you have the emblem of Israel thrown down, becomes a snake, swallows up all of the demonic realm snakes, is then restored to its former glory. But then the story of this staff keeps going. Like, this is going to be the staff that when it's tested to see if God's anointing is on it, what happens to Aaron's staff? It supernaturally begins to blossom, almond blossoms. And it's almond blossoms because that was the first tree to bloom in Israel. It's the first sign of life. It's the first fruits, right, from the season of death. And then it's ultimately allowed to dwell in the, with God in the Ark of the Covenant. So here the story. You have the shepherd, Israel, thrown down to become the snake, restored back to become the shepherd that then yields life all around it, and it dwells with God in a place where sinners are utterly unworthy to dwell, where you can't dwell. You can't even touch it unless you are utterly conformed to the holiness of God. And so this story of the staff is interesting. You see life, atoning death, resurrection, the spreading of the power of life, and the dwelling with God. And so that's the sign given to Pharaoh. And you have to know maybe why Pharaoh doesn't just cut his head off right then. Is this is a really bad omen. This is a powerful message. So then you get to the first plague. Any questions on the staff? You good? All right, so the first plague, verse 13, it says, still Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning. Notice that. We'll talk about that in a minute. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he's going out to the water. Stand on the bank of the Nile to meet him, which means they're in the same town, and take in your hand the staff that turned into a serpent. So it's like, hey, get Aaron's staff. We're still on Aaron's staff. And so you're going to see here that the plagues are divided up into two different patterns. Okay. And I think both of them work. It's like God overlaid two different patterns on top of each other. But the first one, you have 10 broken down into five groups of two, right? So the first two plagues both involve the Nile. So if you know it, it's the water turns to blood and then frogs come out of the Nile, right? So you have waterborne creatures. The second two plagues, 3 and 4, are gnats and lice, tiny bugs.
Bugs.
And then flies or beetles.
Big bugs.
Big bugs. And they're in the sky. So you have water and sky. You've got fish, frogs, lice, and beetles. The third two plagues affect mammals on the land. That's livestock and men. So you've got water, sky, land. He controls all dominions over all different areas, right? Land, sky, and earth, whatever. Land, sky, sea. The fourth two plagues impacts crops on land, and they're coming down from the sky. It's hail and locusts that destroy all the crops from the sky, destroying the land. And then the last two plagues bring the harbinger of death, the 3 days of darkness, and then actual death. And so he's divided up. I think those work. But then there's also these patterns that break down into threes. So there's three triads of plagues. The first of each new set, so that would be plague one, three plagues, then plague four, three plagues, plague seven, then three plagues. They all begin with them, with Moses going out in the morning.
Okay.
You're going to see that. Then the second of each of those triads, so two, five, and eight, Moses goes into Pharaoh's court. The third of each of those plagues is when Pharaoh hardens his heart again, and God says, I'm not even giving him a warning this time. And then the next plague comes unannounced. Like, and you see them grouped together. Like the first three plagues, Aaron's staff is used, but not any others. And if you look for patterns among the threes, you can probably find them too. But this is communicating across every spectrum, all of the dominions, sky, land, sea, creatures that fly, swim, whatever, like God is sovereignly owning all of it, right?
And I know we know there's 10 plagues.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem like Moses is forewarned, right?
Mm-mm. No, he has no idea. He's just been told there's going to be signs and wonders, and eventually Pharaoh will be so broken that he will actually drive you out. He will want you out. He will tell you to leave. And that's how much Moses knows.
Oh, wait, my fun fact.
Yes, fun fact.
This is not the first time we've seen God use plagues to save his people in the Bible.
True story.
God uses plagues to save Sarai. I think she's still Sarah. Because Abraham let her go into Pharaoh's court. And God sent plagues. And Pharaoh's like, get out of here, Sarah. So here we are again.
And we'll send her out with plunder and everything else. So it's like that's a little precursor of what God is going to do. There's all these patterns that repeat themselves in the economy of God. It's like, hint, hint. Learn from this, because history tends to repeat itself. And even the story of the Exodus is pointing to what we're walking through now. So then we get to this long passage. Starting in verse 16, it says, you shall say to him. So this is God telling him, this is what I want you to say to Pharaoh. The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But so far, you have not obeyed. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I'm the Lord. There it is again. Behold, with the staff that's in my hand, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall turn to blood. The fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile will stink, and the Egyptians will grow weary of drinking water from the Nile. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch it out over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, their canals, their ponds, and all their pools of water, so that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, even in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. Like, nowhere is there not going to be blood. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants, he lifted up his staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all the water in the Nile turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died. And the Nile stank so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. There was blood throughout all the land of Egypt.
Ugh.
This would be pretty intense.
And it's worse than what we used, because like the Nile, the blood is like, whatever. I got some water bottles at home.
You're right, right.
But that stinks.
So what do you do? Because this is going to go on for several days. Like, they're not going to have water to drink. And how long can you survive without water?
I have no idea.
Just days, like a few days. And this plague lasts 7 days.
I mean, it sounds like they're drinking the blood.
They're not. So what they end up doing, and we're told, you know, later on, I'm getting ahead of myself, but it says that they start digging along the Nile for water to drink. So it's in their bowls, it's in their tubs, it's in everything. And the only water that they can find to drink is in the water table in a desert land. So they're having to dig and dig and dig and dig and dig until you get this muddied water. And that's the way that they survive. So, I mean, it's not life-ending. It's really, really inconvenient. This is not great. But the message that's going on here would have been super, super, super known and powerful. And that's this. The Egyptians believed that the Nile River, which was the source of all life, they've got all kinds of gods that involve the Nile. But the main one is the Egyptians believed that the Nile River was the bloodstream of Osiris. So the God of the underworld, the God who is responsible for granting you afterlife, the hope of heaven for us, right? Like, this is the God who's joining to earth from the underworld is the Nile River, which kind of, that's his essence in the real world, and it's his bloodstream. In the Book of the Dead, this is the God that basically says you may have an afterlife and be resurrected or not. And now all of a sudden, this contest is beginning. Word is all over Egypt because these guys have been going out gathering straw from every corner of Egypt that there's a contest. And all of a sudden, every Egyptian looks over because they all live near the Nile and the Nile is turning to blood. What are you thinking? Oh my goodness. Like, the Nile actually is turning to blood. Osiris is joining the fight. No, hang on. It's not dead. Osiris is joining the fight. This actually is his blood. And you're like, you're all pumped. You're excited, right? But then what begins to happen? Well, a couple days go by and that blood that at first was okay rots and everything in it begins to die and the fish die and then the blood begins to coagulate and it's rotten and everything in Egypt is absolutely awful. And now what is your only conclusion that you can reach? If this is the bloodstream of Osiris, and that's what it looks like and smells like and what it yields, what do I think about Osiris?
Now he's dead.
He's dead. And if he's dead, what else is dead with him?
Our hope for an afterlife.
Your hope for an afterlife. So now God comes and says, your hope for an afterlife has been put in this God.
Yeah.
And just kills him.
Strong first play.
Yeah. Now your greatest hope, your hope for anything beyond this world. And he just wipes out Osiris. So now imagine how Egypt's feeling. Oh my goodness. Like, one, he just threw a first punch with the staff that says our king is not the rightful king. But now our hope of an afterlife just got rocked. Mm. And I mean, they were like such a moralistic culture. So in doing this, God is not just preaching to leave your gods, but it's also like in that hall of judgment, which comes from the Book of the Dead, where you see Osiris sitting in the back and you had to do all these. You had to recite 42 negative statements to the gods. You had to recite all these spells to the gods if you were deceased and you're walking through the hall of judgment with the hope of getting, you know, to heaven or whatever. So you had to say 42 things. Like in Egypt, to get to heaven, you have to be able to affirm the following. I'm just choosing some examples. You ready? Think about how moralistic this culture is. Because you think Egypt, you think, oh, they're all evil. Well, they were very, very legalistic. So I have never transgressed the law. You say that? I've never stolen. I've never uttered lies. I have never committed adultery. I have never made anyone weep. I've never attacked any man. I've never been an eavesdropper. Are you good on any of these? Slandered any man, been angry without just cause. I've never polluted myself. I've never la 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 shut my ears to the words of truth. I've never stirred up strife. I've never acted with undue haste, which means to be in a hurry for no reason. I've never pried into matters that weren't my business. I've never multiplied my words when speaking, looking for an excuse. I've never done any evil. I've never raised my voice. I've never cursed God. I've never, and my favorite to close, I've never acted with arrogance after you just said I'm perfect.
That, yeah.
But God is coming and he's like, I'm destroying this whole model.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to war and the enemy is actually moralistic.
Huh.
Like, if you could do that, like, God should be like, all right, deal. If I only care about morality.
Keep up the good work, guys.
Book of the Dead's great. Look at all this. I mean, it sounds a lot like the Ten Commandments. There's some good stuff in there. But what's not in that? There's no hope of mercy.
Yeah.
There's no forgiveness. There's no God who loves you unconditionally and makes a way for you to be imperfect. So this you'd better be perfect was a crushing society that salvation came through moralism. And the Egyptians found this so heavy that they actually developed a trick to fool the gods. They would have a scarab amulet put inside their chest with something inscribed on it that was like a spell to fool the gods. And it would say, oh, my heart, which this is on that we've actually found inside the bodies of pharaohs. Oh, my heart, which I had from my mother. Oh, my heart of my different ages. Do not stand up as a witness against me. Do not oppose me in the tribunal. Do you know what it's saying? I'm going to have to look at all these gods square in the face and say, I've never lied.
My heart's going to lie.
Yeah, my heart's going to be like, you know, like, please just shut up. Don't say anything. Because they all know what?
They can't do it.
They can't do it. And yet their only hope is perfection.
It is.
And their only hope is to be able to fool the gods into thinking they're perfect when they know they're not. And God's coming being like, this is garbage.
Yeah.
So your hope of an afterlife, that God, gone, dead. Get him out of here. But then in addition to that, think of all the other gods associated with the Nile. Khnum was considered a creator god who guarded the Nile River. What's he doing? He's failing.
He's asleep, for sure.
He's gone. Then you got Hapi, who's the god of the Nile, that was referred to as the Nile's dynamic essence, called the spirit of the Nile, the lord of the fishes and birds and marshes. Hapi oversaw the annual Nile inundation that determined your crops and fertility and everything else. What's he doing?
Yeah.
Like, he's gone. Taurat was the hippopotamus god of the Nile River. Nu was the god of life over the Nile River. All these gods are just falling. And it's like, if you're an Egyptian, you're like,
what's going on?
Yahweh is busting some justice here. And so the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So it's like they're compounding the blood or making more blood or whatever. As this is happening, the blood spreading, they're adding their own. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he wouldn't listen to them as the Lord had said. So Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not take even this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile River for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 full days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. And so I think it's interesting that the first major public sign that Moses does is mirroring, in a weird way, the first public miracle that Jesus will do, right? So in the first plague on Egypt, but they're different. In the first plague on Egypt, God will turn the waters of Nile into blood, and his first miracle,
water to wine.
Water to wine. So here's another one. In God's plague on Egypt, he demonstrates his power to bring destruction, fear, and death.
Okay.
What's Jesus do? What does his miracle do? It brings blessing, joy, and life. The plague turned the waters of the Nile into a rotting cesspool and a judgment. But the first miracle of Jesus produces the best wine for a wedding feast. And the plague people are desperately digging through dirt to find drinkable water. Where does Jesus pull the water for his miracle? Do you remember?
Purification jars.
And 6 ceremonial purification jars. So like everything is contrasted. What this plague is like, it's like the harsh judgmental side of God coming on the Egyptians to teach them. When Jesus comes, it's like, let me show you that miracle, except it's going to be festive. It's going to be joyful. It's going to be looking forward to a wedding, not a divorce. Like Egypt, you don't get this together. You're out. But God is trying to draw near to his people. And then, so we get to the second plague. Now we're in chapter 8. And it says, then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him. So now we're going into the court. We're in the second of the triad. We're going into the court, says, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go. Sign them over. Give over the deed. They don't belong to you anymore, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will plague all your country with frogs. And immediately, like, if you're reading this and you don't know any context, you're like,
what is going on? Seems like a joke.
Like, this is absurd. Like, it's frogs. That's not scary. Like, what are you like going after the 7-year-old girls that are going to be like, ew, frogs. Like, but this means a lot to the Egyptians. Verse 3, it says, the Nile shall swarm with frogs, and they shall come up into your house and into your bedroom. Hang on to that. And on your bed and into the houses of your servants and your people and into your ovens and your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come upon you and on your people and on all your servants. And so with this one, God is continuing his, you know, move to just start knocking down all the furniture of the houses, you know, and that of the gods of Egypt. And so this one, this plague is associated with the fertility goddess Hekt. And so if you Google that, you look up at all the ancient Egyptian artwork, will show you the head of a frog, body of a man, head of a frog. But if you watch the Nile and all of a sudden all the frogs are coming out of the Nile, you're like, ooh, Hekt is assembling an army. Like the divine realm is coming to help. It's they're coming out of the Nile. They're like, they're with us. But then what happens?
Going all your stuff.
Yeah, they're messing everything up. They're not doing anything. It's just disorder. And so here's the reason why these frogs are the symbol of a fertility goddess. It's a rainstorm comes. What do you hear immediately afterwards? Like the frogs are just everywhere. And it's no accident when it's talking, it says the frogs go into your bedroom and onto your bed. Why? Hecht is a fertility goddess, which means
it's where reproduction.
It's where reproduction happens. And so this is sacred. It's good luck to pregnant women. They used to wear jewelry with frogs around their neck. And Herodotus tells us that frogs are so sacred. Frogs were, cats were, like any divine animal was so sacred that if you killed one of them, guess what the penalty was? Death.
Well, that changes this plug.
Whoa. So now they're everywhere. Imagine trying to walk and yeah. You believe that they're that sacred that it warrants the death penalty to kill these things. And they're going into your ovens, which means you can't
turn them on, use them.
You can't use them, right? They dig into the ground. They put these pots down into the ground. So, of course, the frogs are falling into them. You can't light a fire. You can't cook because it will kill the frogs. And so the first plague took away their ability to drink water. The second plague has taken away their ability to make food. The first plague takes away their afterlife. And if all these frogs are dying and Hecht is ultimately useless or dead.
No more babies.
No more babies. No more life in this world. So everything, God is going, nope, no afterlife, no new life here. No water, no food. Like, and he's very structured in how he's laying this out. It's just fascinating. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand. And you put your staff over the rivers, over the canals, and over the pools, and make frogs come upon the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. But the magicians did the same by their secret arts and made frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Like, that one I don't know, because, like, it's not like they're appearing out of nowhere. They're coming up out of the Nile where they already were, right? And so this is the second time you see magicians able to replicate a miracle. And again, I think that they're doing this through dark arts or something like that. And if you believe in the supernatural realm, that's not a problem. If you think all this is happening naturally, you'll drive yourself crazy because it's impossible. So the magic, their magic only worsens and intensifies the plagues that Yahweh's bringing on. They're like, oh yeah, let us show this miracle.
They wanted the frogs back in the river. They went the opposite direction.
Correct. And so it doesn't work that way. So Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, plead with the Lord to take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. But Moses is playing hardball here. Verse 9, Moses said to Pharaoh, be pleased to command me when I'm to plead for you and for your servants and for your people, that the frogs should be cut off from you and your houses and be left only in the Nile. So here's something that's a weird thing. Pharaoh's like, please make it go away. And Moses is doing something here that sounds weird. Like, why wouldn't Moses just be like, all right, I'll get back to you. I'm going to check with God to see if we can make that happen. He says, no, I want you, Pharaoh, command me. When do you want that to happen? Why is he doing that?
So it can be specific.
So it can be specific, and you know for sure that this is a sign of God. But I want you to think of how, in an attempt to humble this guy, you're like, Moses or Pharaoh, I want you to come to me and tell me, because you can't do it, can you? You've got to come to me and you've got to ask me to do it. Who's superior here, Pharaoh? Who is the one with the power? I want you to command me. And so in this, he's forcing Pharaoh to acknowledge that only God can take away the plague. He's revealing to God, by the way, or to Pharaoh, that God will actually show mercy if he humbles himself. Ask me to pray for you. See what God does for you. If you just acknowledge. He's allowing Pharaoh an opportunity to see if God is sovereign over the timing, and he's showing Pharaoh that there's an impressive power in the prayers of his people. So Pharaoh says something weird that I wouldn't have guessed. He says, tomorrow. Like,
why not now?
This is uncomfortable now. Like, let's go ahead with it. But he says, tomorrow. And Moses said, okay, be it as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. Moses is starting to believe, isn't he? He's not like, man, I hope God comes through. He's like, it'll be as you said. The frogs shall go away from you and your houses and your servants and your people. They'll be left only in the Nile. And so Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord about the frogs as he had agreed to fit with Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses. That's a weird line, right? Usually it's the other way around. And Moses did according to the word of the Lord. No, the Lord did according to the word of Moses.
Well, because Moses kind of led with, this is going to happen and we need God. Right. We need you to make it happen.
And so, but that's an interesting thing. Like, that's pretty humble of God, you know, to even include that in his word. Like, the Lord's like, yes, sir, Moses, I got it. You know, like, it just sounds like, whoa. the frogs died out in the houses, in the courtyards, in the fields, and they gathered them in heaps, and the land stank. So the first plague, what stinks? The river.
Yeah, the fish.
And then the next one, the land stinks. And you see how God is like, it's called a merism when you encompass everything, and he's encompassed everything. Your afterlife is gone. Your life here is gone. Your food, your water. The land reeks, the water reeks. Everything is falling apart for you. And so you're thinking like, surely Pharaoh's getting the picture here. He's not going to win this battle. But verse 15 says, but when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them as the Lord had said. And so can you relate to Pharaoh at all in this? To where it's like when there's a consequence, you're like, yeah, I need to change. And the moment the consequence goes away, you're like, yeah, I'm going to go back to my old ways.
Yeah, even much smaller. I mean, Pharaoh's actually feels like it's a real deal. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know it's God and Moses and there's plagues, but like, he has everything to lose. If I'm walking around saying I'm a God, then this real greater God comes and like that destroys everything I've worked for and built. So I get why Pharaoh's holding on to this.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to lose, but so much to gain. And yet he refuses.
Oh, yeah, he's not going to go to God. Obviously, he could do that, but
I can remember so many times, and I still do this a lot, you know, shamefully, but like I can remember back in my crazier days, like always trying to make promise, like deals with God, you know, like in the morning of a hangover being like, I promise I'll never do this again if, you know, just make this go away, or a crisis would come about or anything like that. And you go to God and you're like, man, I'm all yours. I promise I'll serve you. I'll do whatever you want. I'll stop this behavior if only you get me out of this jam. And then God delivers you either through it or from it. And then the moment you're free again, what do?
Right back to it.
Right back to it. And that's, I mean, there's a little bit of Pharaoh in all of us, and it's just stupid. Yeah. It's so dumb. So we get to the third plague now. So Pharaoh's hardened his heart. God has shown mercy. He's heard the prayer request of his people, you know, all that stuff, and he has granted mercy, and then Pharaoh goes right back to his behaviors. And so this time there's no intervention. So it's the third of the triad, no intervention.
Right on it.
Here comes a surprise. Ready? Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth so that it may become gnats in all the land of Egypt. Now, again, gnats, how you feel about that?
I mean, annoying for sure.
But I mean, if you're like, is your God a warlord? What has he done to you? Well, he made us dig for water. He gave us some frogs and gnats now.
That like, seemed like he's trolling you.
Ooh, you know, like, oh no. But at the same time, this would have been a phenomenal, meaningful symbol to the Egyptians. And so, by the way, this is the first one we're going to see that they can't replicate, and there's meaning to that too. So first off, I want to start the Hebrew word kinim, which is translated as gnats. I'm convinced it means lice. It's not a hill to die on, but it can mean either of those words. It's like the idea is a small bug. But the Egyptians had a terrible fear of lice. They wrote about it all the time, and I think that's what God is doing, and especially among the priests. Lice were considered like unclean. And so the priest had these ridiculous regimens to stay clean. Listen to this. This is from Herodotus, famous Greek historian, lived hundreds of years before Jesus, writing about Egyptian culture. He said, the priests shaved themselves all over their body every other day. Like, maybe you should do that. You need to shave every other day. But he's like, they shave all over their body every other day so that no lice and no other foul thing may come upon them when they minister to the gods. They wash themselves in cold water twice in the day and twice again in the night. So they're shaving every other day and taking four baths a day because they're terrified of lice. If they're at all unclean, they can't worship.
Sure.
So now if they can't worship when they're infested with lice, by the way, you know why? If you ever look at priests and ancient Egyptian artwork, they're always what?
Heads are shaved.
Their heads are shaved. They have no eyebrows. They don't have eyelashes. I mean, there's nowhere for lice to grab hold of, and yet people are covered in lice. So it's even without the hair, what can they not lead?
Worship.
They can't lead worship. So God here with this plague is shutting down the entire Egyptian worship complex. Temples are impure. Altars are impure. Priests become impure. The sacrifices can't be offered. And so with this plague, God is shutting down all of their worship, which I don't think is an accident here. All right, so why do you think this is the first plague that God decides I'm not going to allow them to reproduce this? They have no power to reproduce it. What do you hear in this? He's taking dust and transforming it into living things.
Okay.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, creation.
It's creation. And so he's like, that's my business. So they can't produce life. They can't produce life from death. That's the idea. What does dust always symbolize in the ancient world, in the Bible, and even modern day?
Death.
It's death. You cannot bring life from death. That is uniquely the business of Yahweh. And that's what he's showing here. And now, by the way, we're talking about lice. Your head is not itching. You don't have lice. I don't want you to even think about it.
I don't have any fear of lice.
Your head's not itching right now? Like, no. Whenever I talk about lice, it's like...
I mean, I wouldn't have to shave off my mustache. That would be a sad day.
I'm gonna find lice and throw some eggs in your mustache.
That's
so you crap. Have to get rid of it. But like somebody that's very dear to both of us talks about how like was wearing a school that when there's a case of pinworm going around.
Oh, yes.
Like,
there is.
So one of those very suggestive where everything starts itching. And anyway, talking about lice, it's like I've been thinking like it's going like I just have to scratch. So anyway, verse 17, we got to give context. It says that it may become gnats in all the land of Egypt. I want you to, you know, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth. What all the other plagues, what do they do with their staffs?
They hold it up,
stretch them out, right? But this one is like, I want you to pound it.
I get the dust.
I want you to strike it. And then boom, they did so. And Aaron stretched out his hand with the staff and struck the dust of the earth. And there were gnats. Lice on man and beast, and the dust of the earth became lice in all the land of Egypt. So last appearance of Aaron's staff and the plagues, but this plague is a direct assault on the Egyptian god Geb, who is the god of the earth. Like the Egyptians actually believed that the earth was Geb's body.
Okay.
And so if you take your staff representing your people and you slam it down into the earth, what are you doing?
Stabbing them.
You're slamming it down into Geb's body. Well, here's an interesting little tidbit. In the Book of the Dead, we get a picture of what Geb looks like, and he has a human body with the head of a snake. Now, what do you hear? When third plague.
It's a snake head.
But here you have, wham.
He's going to crush the head of the serpent.
You're coming down on Geb, crushing it, and this is a god with... He's known as the father of snakes, by the way. And because he is the earth, you know what they referred to burial of the dead as, quote, Geb opening his jaws. And so it's like going to war against death, right? I'm pummeling the dust, and it becomes lice that then goes and stops the worship of all your gods. And so let's not forget, this is a staff that was once a staff that became a snake that swallowed snakes that was restored to a staff that's now pummeling Geb, the snake-headed god, to produce lice that goes and covers all of Egypt and puts a stop to worship. And so in this, like, once again, we did a Under the Hood video on this. There is something in antiquity that's written on the hearts of people where there is a hero that goes to war against the serpent. You can look up all these myths. I'm going to read several of them to you. But it's like you just keep finding these. It's Ra versus Apophis, which is Egyptian. Anat versus Lotan. Baal versus Yom. Marduk versus Tiamat. Zeus versus Typhon. Hercules versus Hydra. Perseus versus Medusa. The twins versus the lords of Xibalba. Krishna versus Kaliya. Indra versus Vritra. Thor versus Jormungandr. I love their names. But here you find, like, there's something written all throughout all these ancient cultures. There's news that the hero has to defeat a serpent to bring victory and life to the people. And here you have God, whose first one is, I'm going to take on the serpent and prove that way. But then now he's pummeling Geb, the serpent-headed god of the earth. And it says, verse 18, the magicians tried by their secret arts to produce these gnats or lice, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beasts, and they can't produce life from the dust. So then the magicians, when they see this is beyond us, like how did he just do that? Like how did he make life come from death? Because that's not a power that demons can do. And they said, this is the finger of God.
Hmm.
But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, And he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. So now you've got in his inner circle people already going, this is too much. Like,
we can't do this.
Back away. Like, this, for real, this is the finger of God. And there's something interesting in Egyptian writing. Whenever they talked about the finger, it's used in terms of magic, creation, care, and it meant like creative stuff. But when you use the hand for a god, it's power, judgment, and war. And so when they say this is the finger of God, it's almost a warning. In other words, like, these first few plagues has not been the hand, the mighty hand of a god. They've been the finger. They're creative. It's like, you know, they were inconvenient. I think maybe we should rethink things before we start getting into the hand. And in the next triad of plagues, what you're going to find is the intensity of the plagues just keeps jumping. They're going to start losing industry and wealth. And by the end of it, you're going to find like intense suffering by the time the plagues end. And at every turn, though, all the people are like, stop, stop, stop. You're destroying everything. You can't keep doing this. Let go of your pride and your ego. Submit. Realize that you are not God over this place. You are not on the throne. Pharaoh just keeps upping the ante, hardening his heart, and the plagues are going to go from the finger of God to the mighty hand of God and the outstretched arm of God as they get more and more intense. All right, so what do you take away from all of this?
I mean, even just as we talked about at the beginning, just even the grace of God to use these plagues to save some. Mm-hmm. Not just the Israelites, but also the Egyptians. Even like, I forget that the magicians are like, this is God pretty early on in this whole scene.
Yeah, we got seven more plagues to go, and they're already like, we're out.
Yeah,
like, I don't think this is a good idea. And it gets back to like, if I want to leave people with any encouragement, it's this. Like, if you're walking through a season where all of your things precious to you are getting upended, you know, that don't assume that's the cruelty of God, because you're in the moment and it feels painful. God does some of his most compassionate work at taking away our idols.
Yeah.
And you see that all throughout life. I can look back at my life and, you know, idol smashing is painful when you lose things that you love or things that are your security or things that mean the world to you. And yet, if you will grab hold of him, trust him through the process, he is going to bring about something far more glorious than your idols ever could have imagined. And the most loving thing that a God could do is, if it brings you closer to him and what he can provide you, is to smash all of that other stuff and not allow them to be your master anymore. And so a good prayer and a scary prayer is, God, I have a lot of precious things. One, help me to order those loves like you talked about, to where you're over my marriage and you're over my family and you're over my money and my career and my ministry and all those other things that are under God. But Lord, if there is something that's a master in my life, good or bad, and it's unseating you, smash it to draw me closer to you. That's a big prayer. And God honors that prayer. And it also reveals to you, if you can authentically make that prayer, your loves are rightly ordered.
Yep.
Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, we're going to stop there. Next time we'll get into the next triads of the plagues. I want to thank everybody so much for watching this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next week and we'll continue right along. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.